Welcome. This is Christopher Holmes, and it is May 2nd, 2009, and this is Zero Point Radio Show on BBS Radio. This is a forum for discussions of esoteric, mystical, and spiritual teachings, modern science, commentary upon the contemporary struggles of humankind. Cover a wide range of topics and subjects. My background, I'm a clinical and forensic psychologist and consider myself a mystic scientist. Zero Point is a term taken from Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine, and it indicates or suggests a first point or a last point. A zero point is a point so small it kind of disappears from view. In the creation of the universe, scientists think the universe began from a singularity condition that it could be considered a zero point. And then the universe grows within without from a zero point, like the budding of a lotus, and that's the expanding universe. And eventually, according to Blavatsky's secret doctrine, the universe will contract without within back to a zero point and back into the nothingness. So according to Blavatsky's secret doctrine, the life principle in any living cosmos originates from a zero point and eventually dissipates back into a zero point. And human beings are said to have such zero point centers. In a way, we can describe ourselves as having one zero point center, and that, I would say, is connected to the higher dimensional physics of the human heart. Not only the heart, because in one sense I might say you have one zero point, but then that one manifests as seven zero points, and each of the chakras or energy vortices in the body, there are seven of those, and each of those has a zero point center. All differentiations out of the one. So I work under the logo of Zero Point Institute for Mystical and Spiritual Science and try to interrelate or explain mystical teachings in light of modern science and how they relate to modern science and modern psychology. See, in modern science and psychology, we've neglected the science of the soul for over a century. And that goes back to the emergence of materialist philosophy and reductionist approach in science and the dismissal of the soul, and human beings are only higher primates who happen by chance because of random mutations to evolve on the planet Earth. So modern psychology and science for a century has dismissed the science of the soul, and that's what has the area that I explore, and that is the ancient meaning of psychology itself, because psyche meant soul, and logos means the science or knowledge of a subject. So psychology is, in the esoteric meaning, the science of the soul. And it's only in modern times that it became defined as a science of behavior and the mind, and human beings were viewed in a dualistic way. So I have a Zero Point website at www.zeropoint.ca, and I have selections from the six books I have up on site, as well as various articles and writings and pictures and musical links and some video clips and YouTube presentations of my work. So I hope people will explore zeropoint.ca. Now, I'll introduce my co-host in a moment, and then I'm going to take a bit of time and give a talk on some esoteric studies. But for the moment, I'll bring in co-host James Moffat. Jim, how are you?
Good. How are you, Chris?
Okay, good. Nice day here. earlier spring this year.
Yeah, it's nice for me to be able to talk. I didn't have a voice for about 4 days, and had a hard time talking for a couple of weeks, which may have actually been good discipline for me in keeping silence, but I was quite sick with laryngitis, so it's nice, nice to be back and able to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought I'd go back to some basic esoteric studies today and explain the laws of 3 and 7 a little bit go into a talk about that and relate that to important symbolism. So I thought maybe I'd go into that for a while, and I'll talk on that, and then anytime you want to come in, or you know, at some point, I'll turn it over to you if you have any kind of comments or elaborations on things I've been saying.
Yeah. It's always, in terms of the study of mystical and esoteric doctrines, it's amazing how, I think the most interesting aspect in a way of it intellectually about trying to work with these ideas is how you can continue to revisit and, re-examine these ideas, and your knowledge of them is continually changing as you develop other ideas related to these things, which drawn from both esoteric and mystical studies and from self-study in terms of esoteric and mystical studies, but also from modern science and modern knowledge. It's amazing how, I'd say over the course of the past 30 years that we've been studying these things, how your knowledge is continually developing and evolving. It's quite a fascinating process in and of itself.
Absolutely.
I think that's what validates it most for me, is that it continually grows. It's like at one point Uspensky said of the fourth way teaching of Gurdjieff that unlike other ideas, he had the feeling that he was in touch with something organic and something that was alive in itself. And I would say that sort of characterizes the esoteric tradition for you and I think we both share that opinion, that it's like being involved with something that's continually evolving and is organic and dynamic. It doesn't feel like a thing that you're studying. It's like you're communing and communicating with an intelligence of some sort, which is continually manifesting and crystallizing in new dimensions of meaning.
Yeah. And always giving new insights and illuminations and understanding things more deeply.
Yeah.
That's so true. Like the one thing I wanted to talk about today was the law of 7. And I think how, like 30 years ago, I began reading the Fourth Way book, and Gurdjieff explained that the law of 7 is one of the 2 fundamental cosmic laws. Okay, and you can understand the concept of the law of 7 pretty easy in a way. You think, oh yeah, it means that there are 7 of everything, kind of.
Yeah.
So, and that's like the basic aspect of it. But you might wonder, well, like studying the law of 7, okay, then you have to find all different applications of it, and then in symbolism and applied to all different things, applying the law of 7 to try to understand different subject areas. So the idea of the law of 7 is something that grows and grows and grows, and it's so simple on one level, but when you get into it, it has that whole inner mystery and depth to it.
And it develops in so many different ways within you yourself. As you understand it more, you begin to incorporate it, and it becomes something of a construct through which you see things, and it challenges sort of accepted and conventional ideas about things, but at the same time it grows in you. It becomes deeper in you, within you emotionally and in terms of your being. It's very hard to describe kind of what I'm trying to suggest, because we don't really have a good language for this type of development of knowledge, but it's more than development of knowledge. It's development of knowledge and understanding, and it's I would say like the cultivation of wisdom, and in terms of the law of 7 and the law of 3, both it's the interaction of these fundamental ideas is so complex. yet at the same time, it becomes so concrete to you in certain ways that you just, after a certain time, you just begin to see things in these ways. And as I say, it challenges sort of conventional ideas, like in terms of the law of three, revealing, as an example, reveals how people tend to see everything dualistically and to construct things intellectually in terms of dualities, whereas the law of three suggests that you should always try to understand things in a terms of the interaction of three forces. And then linking that with the law of seven, it provides one of the aspects of the law of seven is that nothing unfolds in continuously, that there are two shock points in the seven notes that develop the octave of the law of seven, and that if these shocks aren't filled at the proper intervals, then they begin to deviate, and this and become something that starts as in one direction with one goal, becomes, because of deviation, something quite different. And this is like a really profound aspect of the law of seven, which is related to octaves that aren't fulfilled. So there's trying to understand octave processes that are fulfilled in all manifestations of existence, and at the same time there's also the idea of how the law of seven describes how things don't get fulfilled, which is a very, very, very powerful idea. And as I say, the interaction of those two cosmic laws, I mean, they're two basic ideas. Like on one level, as you say, you can understand, the law of three says that everything consists of threes. And the law of seven is that there are seven notes in any process that have to be fulfilled to complete it. Well, that's a very rudimentary and actually quite precise description, but it's only the beginning of understanding things like, well, you could study that for the rest of your life and not even come close to understanding all of its ramifications and implications for things.
Yeah. It's so interesting. I was listening to, I listen at night to a BBS radio show often, Don Nikoloff, and he was on Evident Footprints. And, goodness, I'm losing what I was going to say. And he used the phrase about the creation hologram. And I like that. Oh, creation hologram. Because mystical teachings do present a holographic model of the nature of reality. And by that, we mean in a sense that in mystical teachings, ultimately, everything is interrelated and part of one living whole. And there's interconnection on all different levels between everything. Everything ultimately is part of one whole, which of course makes sense in modern science because the universe originates from a singularity. And whenever particles separate, they always maintain interrelationship with the other particles they've interacted through what's called higher dimensional phase space. So, which is like information fields. So as the universe originates from a point, and even as the universe becomes so diverse, still at different levels, everything is interrelated and part of one. And that's kind of, a basic, and we find that teaching in the secret doctrine, in Gurdjieff, in Vedic teachings, in Christianity, in Kabbalah. But ultimately, all things are part of one. And all of those esoteric teachings present a holographic model, in a sense, then, of the nature of reality, of how everything could be interrelated. It is a holographic. The term hologram means to write the whole. Holo meaning whole, and gram mean to write. So a hologram means a human being somehow embodies the whole, is a particle of all that exists. Blavatsky says about how the universe concentrates itself in the point, in some sense. And I was thinking, creation hologram. And then I was thinking how in the sacred books, like in the book of Genesis, in the beginning, when God initiates creation, he says, let there be light. And then if we consider light, and then to understand light, if we divide it by a prism, which is three-sided, you get a spectrum of seven colors. So how the idea of the one divided by three gives you seven. And in a way, that is like a little magical formula of the universe, that the one is divided by three and gives you seven. And we find that basic concept of that, we find it in Kabbalistic teachings, as well as in Christianity and the Vedic teachings, and in Gurdjieff Uspensky and other sources. So these are, Gurdjieff would call this objective knowledge, the laws of three and seven, that these are fundamental cosmic laws. So that description of the one divided by three and gives seven, that describes the dynamics of light. So the idea, see, to create a hologram, you need a light source. And usually provided by a laser. You have a point source of light. So the idea that creation is a manifestation of light, then to have the idea that of the laws of three and seven makes perfect sense in trying to understand how creation might proceed. And in the Kabbalistic tree of life, this is the most wonderful mystical symbol. First you have 10 spheres, or sephira, on the tree of life. And you have the first three form a upward turned triangle. And those are called the supernals. So you have three supernals. And then below, you are said to have seven lower sephira. So you have the seven below. And so you add the three supernals and the seven below, and you get the 10, which is the Kabbalistic tree of life. And that tree of life stands on three pillars, because you have the masculine, active, male pillar, and this headed by the supernal father, Chakma. And then on the other side, you have the supernal mother, which is Binah, who's the head of that pillar. And then you have Keter, which is the head of the central pillar. So this idea of the laws of three and seven are inherent to the Kabbalistic teaching. Now also, if you look at the tree of life, and if I've drawn it out before me, it helps to see these things, but if you take the first three sephira, and you join them, and you have an upward turned triangle. Okay, then if you take the next three sephira and join them, you have a downward turned triangle. Okay, that's the way that though, which, so in a way, now the upward turned triangle, it represents in magic the element of fire. Okay, and the downward turned triangle represents the element water. So the two triangles, what we see is the idea as above, so below. So it's as if you take, I'm putting my hands in front of me and making a triangle with my hands and seeing it as an upward turned triangle, as above, and then it drops, so the peak falls below, and it becomes a downward-turned triangle. And that represents water, the element water. As above, so below. The above, the triangle is turned upwards, and then below, the triangle is turned downwards. And if you overlap those two triangles, you have what's called the Star of David. Or it's also called the Seal of Solomon, which is the six-pointed star. Okay, that's a very ancient mystical teaching in many traditions, not only in Kabbalah and Judaism, but it's also called Vishnu's shield. And in the descriptions of the chakras, they put a Star of David on the heart chakra, which is the central chakra. So this is a very esoteric symbol. And it represents the Star of David. It represents the interaction of fire and water. And if you turn to the book of Genesis, this is Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. Okay, so there I would say we have a triad. In the beginning, there's God and creates the heaven and the earth. So there's a threefoldness there. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. You see, in esoteric teachings, there's this interaction of the base of spirit or fire and water, representing the male and female aspects of nature. So, in a way, in the second verse of Genesis, we have inherent in that the Spirit of God moving across the face of the waters. Inherent in that is the mystical symbol of the Star of David, which representing the mixture of heaven and earth, actually it might be, or spirit and water. What's very interesting in Blavatsky is that, see, I were to take the Star of David, I would say, well, it has six lines, six points, and six angles. So the Star of David represents the number 666. Yeah. And that is the on the Star of Israel. Is the Star of David, representing 666. And Blavatsky says the key to the Star of David is the central point. And she puts in the interior of the Star of David a little ankh. An ankh is a Egyptian symbol. It looks like a cross, except the part above the crossed arms is a circular, looking like a head. So that's a picture of an ankh. And in Egyptian mysticism, it represents the life principle within a person, the ankh, the living entity. So in Blavatsky's teachings of theosophy, she puts an ankh within the center of the Star of David. Or if you go to my website, you see the Star of David have a central point. In fact, the Star of David differentiates from a point. So it's very different to have a Star of David without a central point, which is a symbol of creation, and then to have a Star of David with a central point, which represents like the higher self or the God principle, individualized God element within the human being. So that's one example of the Law of Seven. And we find the Law of Seven also, it's in the book of Genesis, in that God creates the universe in 6 days and rests on the seventh. So again, if we take creation, takes 6 days, like the two triangles, and God rests on the seventh. So I would put the seventh is the ankh, which anchors the life principle within the heart, and that's in the center of the Star of David. So I think the Star of David with the central point is inherent in the book of Genesis, and is this kind of hidden aspect to Judaic and Christian teaching. That the Star of David, yeah, and the idea of God resting on the seventh. See, the central point in the Star of David has a different significance or stature as the seventh point relative to the other six points. Okay, in the Kabbalistic Tree of Life, what you have is you have the supernal triad, and those come down and they're anchored into the Sephira of Tiphereth, which is associated with the heart and with the sun. So I would say the point within the Star of David represents Tiphereth, or the self. Okay, so this idea then, see, that's another way of arriving at seven, right, is to consider the interaction of the elements and the Star of David. Any comments, Jim?
Well,
and I was going to, actually, you talked about the octave before, but let's come back to that, because I was going to look at the law of seven related to the law of the octave in the moment.
Well, I kind of see a recurring thing here in the sense that, in a way, like, I mean, I don't know if this is extrapolating too much, but it's, in a sense, it's like you have this, this point that you're talking about that's in the tree of life, and that's in the, if you place it as Blavatsky does within the Star of David, it's kind of like this, and even like God resting on the seventh day, it's all kind of symbolic of the idea of something being latent, like a void or latent or something that's not manifest, but which is critical and dynamic and is sort of at the heart of things, like literally and figuratively at the heart of things, and that kind of recurs throughout things. Like, I mean, even within, like, you know, the description you have about, like, these zero points being, that we're manifestations of these zero points. It's like there's always this, like, this critical element which is beyond material representation or perception, but which is essential and which is really completes the process. But in the kind of lower thinking level of human beings, like human beings asleep, don't see this. Like it's invisible. Like it just is in the people are third force blind in their normal waking state of consciousness because they tend to see things dualistically. I'd say the same thing in a way about about the law of seven, that they don't see this, and also about the terms of zero points, that you don't see that which is critical because it's not materially, or it's not manifest, but it's latent, it's empty, and yet it's a void, and yet it's a plenum which underlies all of this, so it informs things. One thing about 666 is that if you divide 3 into 2, you get 666, and I kind of think it's...
Wow, that's interesting.
Well,
divide 3 into 2, yeah, you get 0.666.
So
yeah.
I kind of think, like, 666 refers to, like, formatory mechanical consciousness, which is the two without the third element. Like it's the three is divided into the two, which gives you a partial, which is this fraction, fractional consciousness, which is 666. And it's funny because it's like 666, which repeats itself. It never completes itself, so it's perfect in a way. It's kind of like mechanical formatory consciousness. It's like it's rote. And it's incomplete, and it's non-reflective in a sense, and so like to complete, you'd have to divide 3 into 3 rather than 3 into 2. I mean, I don't know. Maybe that's I've always thought that.
No, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
That's really, I've never considered that. You know, it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's an example kind of what I was talking about earlier. It's like where you see things, you know, that you see possibilities. I mean, like, in terms of your study of the Kabbalah, like, I think if you had studied the Kabbalah before studying Gurdjieff, I think you would have grasped some of these things. But once you understand the Law of 3 and 7, I think it gives you a very good framework for understanding a lot of other esoteric teachings. I think it's just such a critical... There's such critical ideas to apply to things. One thing I just wanted to say very quickly, just when you were talking earlier about the creation hologram, it's like that's the thing about the esoteric teachings too, is that in a way, I mean, people who are skeptical or who don't understand mystical and esoteric teachings hear a phrase like something when somebody says that they were one with the universe and they kind of laugh at it and mock it, but in a way, like it's, I mean, it's, as you understand the dynamics of underlying this and what this is really speaking about the realization of the self and how it, in some sense, the self is identical with the universal structure, so many different things begin to take on such different meaning. And I mean, one of the most, I think, profound ideas is how Once you understand an esoteric conception of what it means to realize the self, what to know thyself, and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. When you understand what that, begin to grasp what that means, then you see the parallels. Like in science, like, I mean, many people have suggested perhaps the most startling and difficult idea to recognize the significance of in 20th century physics is Bell's theorem and the idea of non-locality. But mystical and esoteric teachings in the holographic model of creation is entirely consistent with Bell's theorem. I mean, it provides a completely different framework, which is basically what your work's about, to understand how Bell's theorem applies and how it applies not only to the physical universe but to the nature of consciousness.
Yeah, it was because of that enigma in quantum theory that Einstein wouldn't accept theory because he couldn't believe in that level of wholeness and interrelatedness between things.
Yeah.
That was inherent to quantum theory. There had to be something wrong. He thought it couldn't all be interrelated in that way.
And
that's why he posed the EPR paradox.
Yeah, exactly.
He tried to show how that couldn't be really true.
But it turned out that it is. And I mean, there's the famous lines from William Blake when he says, "To see a world in a grain of sand and heaven in a wildflower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand and eternity in an hour." It's like, you know, he poetically and through his elevated states of consciousness, like Blake had an intuitive an experiential grasp and an intuitive grasp of how time and space could be collapsed and how these things could be possible through these exalted states of consciousness. And it's all of these different poems and reflections through the ages from people who have had mystical experiences and attempts to translate into language these ineffable experiences that they've had are all consistently revealed. You can begin to understand the depths of them once you begin to have a schema which recognizes these critical principles. And as you say, like one that God, there's an ancient saying that God is first one, then three, then seven. It's a very simple saying, but it's the key to everything. If you really understand that, if you really know that and understand that, just as like man, know thyself and thou wilt know the universe and the gods. These are profound ideas and have incredible depth the more you know and the more you study yourself in terms of these ideas.
So, exactly. There's such deep, amazing ideas. So let's just go back a moment. You mentened earlier the idea of the missing semitones, and I'd like to just say something about why sometimes the law of seven is called the law of the octave. An octave implies eight. Okay, and the way to think of this, it's like a musical scale, and Gurdjieff used the musical scale to explain the law of seven. He said that the musical scale was actually developed to embody the law of seven to be passed to future generations, and it's related to Pythagoras. So the law of the octave, we go do, re, mi, in a musical octave, in an ascending octave, we go do, re, mi, and then between mi and fa, you have a missing semitone. And on a piano keyboard, that's where there's no black note between two white notes. Okay, because between do and re, you have a black note, and then re and mi, you have a black note. But then between mi and fa, there's no black note, half note. And then you get to fa, which is number four, fa, sol, la, si, which then are the higher three. And then the eighth would be is regarded as the completion of the seventh is in the eighth. So the eighth, in a way, contains the whole of the seven within itself, or it's a completion of the seventh. That's why Gurdjieff, on one occasion, he says that there are seven levels of human being. human evolution. There are seven levels of awakening and realization the human being can attain. And Gurdjieff at one point, I think, describes Christ as a man number seven. And people often talk about the number 777 is the Christ number. But then on one occasion, at least, Gurdjieff describes Christ as a man number eight. So I guess a man number eight is the one who's kind of attained the Christed level and then dissolved into the infinite, merged with the Father or with God. So that would be like a man number eight to experience that. So the idea then is very important. The idea is that the universe has seven levels of creation. There's not just one level, there's not just the material universe, but actually there are seven levels of materiality. And these are interpenetrating levels that exist throughout space and time. So we, in a way, don't just exist in one world, but we exist simultaneously within seven worlds on seven different levels. And Gurdjieff explains that creation of the universe is what he calls a descending octave, because you begin with God, and then God devolves, so going from top do to the bottom do is a devolution or involution. And then the opposite, evolution, is ascending from the lowest again, returning to the source. That's evolution. So in Gurdjieff, it's very important, this idea of there being both descending and ascending octaves. And the creation process is a devolution, and then the worlds are created, and then once the worlds are created, then there's the evolution of organic life and the evolution of human beings. And that's the evolutionary process. And this is very profound, even though quite simple, because in science today, scientists only have the concept of evolution. They don't have this notion of there being involution and evolution. Okay, so when God becomes a stone, isn't evolution. That's involution. That's a diminution of the infinite into a stone, something very concrete. Okay, so whereas in science, all change is regarded as evolution. And this is very valuable in mystical teachings. There's an involutionary process which then leads to the possibility for evolution. And Gurdjieff explains that there can be seven levels of human development or attainment. And he says most people in life become only what he calls a man number one, two, or three. And that's from in the ascending octave. That would be a do, a re, or a mi. And Gurdjieff explains that these are the do is a physical type, and re is the emotional type, and then mi is the intellectual type. And Gurdjieff explains that most people in life are a man number one, two, or three, according to which of their physical, emotional, or intellectual aspect is most developed. And he says the idea in the fourth way is that we want to develop physically, emotionally, and mentally and bring these three into alignment, and then it awakens to the next level of the fourth element, or do, re, mi, fa, is attaining to fa, is to get across the gap, because you have the do, re, mi, and then you have a missing semitone. So at that point, evolution tends to come to a standstill. You go do, re, mi, but then you don't get further. And he says most human beings don't get to the next level of their evolution, attain to the re. And the experience of do, re, mi, fa, attaining to the level of fa, And for Gurdjieff, the attaining to the level of the level Fa occurs within the person who attains the state of self-consciousness. Okay. Yeah, this is the state of the self-consciousness, and he associates it with the opening of the higher emotional center. And so that, I would see, that's what I would associate with the human heart and the heart chakra. And then, see, if we take a human being that has seven chakras, you have the heart chakra is the fourth chakra, and you have three below it, which you might represent with a downward turn triangle, and you have three above it. The ones below the heart chakra are the physical aspects to self, the earth aspects, and the parts above it are the spiritual, or the heaven aspects. And the heart is kind of between the material worlds below and the spiritual worlds above. So for Gurdjieff, if someone can breach that missing semitone and attain to Fa, become a man number four, then that person might develop the characteristics and experiences of a man number five, six, or seven, these higher types. And that would involve the awakening, these spiritual qualities within the person. Now, on the lower level, it is said we have a physical body, an astral body related to our emotions and desires, and then a mental body. So those are the three lower bodies. And then those three lower bodies are there have counterparts in the spiritual worlds above. The physical body is related to the highest body called the Atmic body. And that is associated with the attribute of will, like higher will, divine will. And the astral body is related to this in the spiritual world, that's called the Buddhic body. And the basis of higher mystical and religious emotions, the Buddhic body. And the manas, or the mental body, is represented on a higher level to manas, like divine thought. So on the lower level you have physical thought and practical intelligence, but on a higher level you have spiritual knowledge. I would relate that to spiritual knowledge. So you have your three physical bodies below, and you have your three spiritual bodies above, and between them is the heart center. And the idea is that normally the heart is controlled by the three lower centers. That's why it is said that people are mainly motivated by money, sex, and power, which are the motives associated with the three lower chakras. Okay, for a person then to attain, to transcend that level and attain to the awakening of the heart, and that's the level of, that's the experience of realization of real I connected to the heart, to the essential consciousness in the person is connected to the heart. And then subsequent to that, the light of the heart and the illumination of the heart can then illuminate the three higher centers, so a person can experience higher faculties and experiences related to the higher being bodies. So you might experience levels of higher emotions, experiences where people feel filled with love and compassion, and they feel that towards humankind, like to all sentient beings. That's a higher example of Buddhic emotion, or spiritual knowledge, or divine will. So to have those attributes we would want to attain to on a higher level. Okay, so, but mostly human psychology is conditioned by the three lower aspects of a human being. And then we don't get to the level of a man number four and awaken the heart, and we're ignorant then of the higher being bodies. So again, we have the idea of I'm talking about is applying the law of seven to trying to understand the idea of evolution and how the heart chakra is kind of critical in the attain of the evolution of humankind. Like I would say at this point on planet Earth, what we need is a massive awakening of the heart in human beings. That people, the awakening of the heart, and then for that awakening of the heart to illuminate the mind. That will be the next step forward in human evolution. But as it is, people have become conditioned by money, sex, and power, and the whole material realm. And so they don't awaken to these higher facets of themselves. Okay, Jim, any comment on that? It's so beautiful, eh? Everything is so consistent in a way, eh? Like how the heart's the center and you have three below and three above, eh? They're beautiful ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And that is true. It's entirely consistent and coherent and elegant and just totally captivating in a sense. There's an aesthetic beauty to it. I always laugh when scientists criticize mystical or dismiss mystical ideas as being vague and insubstantial and, you know, not demanding of any kind of intellectual effort or integrity to understand them. Is precisely the opposite. But so I think
they're more complex, more subtle than the kind of dualistic thinking. Like you see in science, scientists ask, is there an immaterial mind to connect to the material body?
Yeah.
No, but it's always they think of it in a dualistic way.
Well, and also, I mean, and this is the thing that I was going to comment upon that you mentioned, which I think is the, one of the most important ideas, like just absolutely critical, is this idea that everything in the universe doesn't just simply consist of evolution, but there's what Gurdjieff calls these two currents. There's the involution or devolution, and there's the evolution, so that you have this, in a way, like it's like the Big Bang. You know, we know that we have this idea in science that the Big Bang created the universe, and really in the esoteric teachings, they're saying, well, the unity, the absolute, which created the universe or from which the universe issues, is always occurring. It's always descending and creating this series of world orders, these seven world orders, which become increasingly denser and ruled by more laws, but each of the higher levels subsumes the lower levels, and at the same time informs the lower levels, and this is a very important idea. And then at the same time that's the involutionary current. At the same time you have the evolutionary current, where things are growing more complex and where they're ascending in intelligence. But what's so critical in Gurdjieff's scheme of the octave, it's this idea that there are two places where shocks are required for the octave to fulfill itself. And if it doesn't fulfill itself, if the shocks aren't provided, then the octave will deviate and it will either cease to exist or it will become something quite different. But in the grand scheme of things, Gurdjieff says there are always these two currents, and you have this continual building up and descending going on at all times, and human beings exist like between these two currents, and we can either mechanically evolve and be stuck in one of the three lower levels, like of the intellectual, the emotional, or physical human being, or we can begin to complete ourselves through our efforts, and that we require that shock, which in a sense could be seen as esoteric teachings, to help us develop consciousness and being and begin to ascend to become what he calls the man number four, to hit fa in terms of the octave. But this idea is completely missing in modern thought and modern science. So you have, because of that, you have like what Ken Wilber, the consciousness theorist, talks about, the collapse of the hierarchy and the flat land of modern science. And this is creates all kinds of illusions and misapprehensions and misinterpretations and wrong ideas about the nature of things. So then you have things being cast in this formatory way. Like, yeah, is there an immaterial mind which affects a material body? Well, no. What it is that there are higher levels of materiality which are informing lower levels of materiality, and you have to understand that we exist in this cosmic octave which both ascends and descends. And once you have that schema, once you have that understanding, many of the anomalies and enigmas and mysteries that confront modern science, because it's stuck in this flatland, become explicable, and explicable in elegant and coherent terms, because you begin to understand, well, you can't explain everything. You can provide brilliant explanations and descriptions of things on the material level, but they won't be comprehensive explanations because they don't recognize the existence of these higher levels. I mean, I could say a lot more, but that's enough.
yeah, exactly. The mystical teachings are far more explicit. Like, it's how in modern science they think there's only the physical body. Whereas in mystical teachings, well, you don't only have your physical body, but you have your astral body and your mental body. And each of those is a different body upon a different plane of materiality. So you really have, well, I would say six bodies, because these are bodies for the seventh element. That's how I would see it.
Yeah.
You have three on the lower, the physical levels, and three on the higher levels. And the seventh is that special kind of the self, the Ankh kind of within the heart. So it's a much more differentiated view of how we have different bodies, and there are different planes of existence, of possible existence, that we could die and pass over and live in the astral world. And we could live there for years and years and live in astral homes and interact with other people in the same astral realms. Or we could exist in mental realms. Like, we could exist within these different planes of being. We already do exist within these different planes of being. But some of them will predominate in our consciousness. So most people were only aware of the physical aspect of things, even though we're simultaneously in all of these worlds and we have all of these bodies. I think one idea that's really useful here is Gurdjieff's story about where he compares human beings. He has Fritz Peters, and he tells a story about all the acorns under an oak tree. And Gurdjieff asks Fritz Peters, how many of those acorns will become oak trees? And Peters kind of says, well, he doesn't know, maybe only a few. And Gurdjieff says, yeah, maybe just a few, maybe one, maybe none at all. And he compares human beings. He says, like, we all have this potential to become oak trees, kind of, which in his teaching would be to attain our higher being bodies for the life of the soul. And that, for Gurdjieff, is how you attain your soul, is through developing your higher being bodies for the life of the soul. And then Gurdjieff says, but most people, it's just like nature, he says, most people don't attain to the life of the soul. And so the acorns break down, and he says they become fertilizer for a future possible evolution of a human being. And in Gurdjieff's teaching, a soul can at death be drawn into the lower worlds and could even pass to the moon. Gurdjieff says the moon kind of feeds off the souls of humankind. And there are descriptions in the mystical literature that people can actually pass to the moon. Gurdjieff describes the dark side of the moon as like a hell world that people can be drawn into. And Adi Da, in his visions, describes people being like in a prison work camp environments on the moon and being enslaved by the moon, which is how Gurdjieff always talks about the moon, that people become enslaved by the moon.
Right.
Whereas Gurdjieff says, really, he says, we come from the sun. He says at one point, Nicole, one of his students, says, man is an experiment of the sun. So in a way, the higher self, or the real self, is connected to the sun. And what Gurdjieff says, we want to, if we can develop our higher mental body, our spiritual body, then we attain to the level of the sun. So in this teaching, a person might actually pass into the sun and exist within a spiritual world within the sun. And different mystics describe this, there being spiritual worlds within the sun, which is all quite consistent with people who have near-death experiences, and they pass down the tunnel and they emerge into this spiritual heavenly type world. Well, if we look in the world around us and think, where might there be such a realm of higher existence and light? And what you would see is the sun. So for Gurdjieff, we can actually pass not in our physical bodies into the sun, but in our higher being body, in our mental body for Gurdjieff. If we attain to the level, attain our mental body, then he says we become immortal within the limits of the solar system. That's one level, he says, of attainment, that we become immortal within the limits of the solar system. So that would be to attain to our spiritual body. So again, it's interesting how you have the soul of man is connected to the heart, and it can either serve lower purposes or the purposes of nature, as Gurdjieff explains them. And at death, we can feed the moon and be, that's devolution, where we kind of descend and we're further removed from the light of the sun and the light of true existence. Or we can attain to the spiritual world upon death, which is the aim of yogis. In Tibetan Buddhism, you aim upon death to pass into the greater body of radiance. And then if you don't attain to the greater body of radiance, which is actually the starry world, then you can attain to the lesser body of radiance, which is the sun. So, the fate of a man kind of depends upon what they see. Gurdjieff's teaching is so interesting in that most religions kind of teach everybody has a soul and everybody has an eternal element within them. And Gurdjieff would also, I think, agree with that. But Gurdjieff says, like, blessed is he who's attained his soul. I forget, do you know that expression, Jim, where he says, but mercy upon them who haven't.
Blessed is he who hath a soul, blessed is he who hath not, but fear in something or other to one who's in the process of making one. Something to that effect, like basically, like, if you got a soul, okay. If you don't have a soul, okay. But if you're in the process of making one, watch out.
that process of attaining a soul.
Yeah. Because in his scheme of things, he says that you are that in order for the crystallization of this higher being element within one, you have to suffer and you have to break through the kind of the crust of personality and the lower elements that keep us trapped within the sensory and the physical realm, and so that to make a soul is a process that, like, you have to be in the fire in a sense to burn away this crust and to decrystallize the lower element. But in a way, like, too, there's a whole other aspect to what you're saying about, I've always kind of wondered about this, about Gurdjieff, but other remarks he's made about the soul is that he says that people don't understand that the possibilities for everything in life are limited. And at one point, Uspensky asked him a question. Like, Uspensky was very much fascinated by the idea, the Nietzschean idea of eternal recurrence, which was that we live the same life over and over again, but we can't remember it, so we can't escape from it. And so we don't die so much as we pass from one incarnation to another and repeat the same things. And at one point, Gurdjieff said to Uspensky, he was kind of playing him a little bit, and he said, well, you know, I'll answer a question to cheer him up. And he asked him about eternal recurrence. And Gurdjieff said, well, you know, there's a great deal in what you say. Like, he was, Uspensky was explaining the idea of eternal recurrence, the Nietzschean idea. And Gurdjieff said, there's a great deal in what you say about this. And look, if I told you that you're right, you know, what good would it do to you? Because the idea is that we want to wake up in this lifetime, and we want to develop consciousness and being in this lifetime. So if I tell you, okay, you're going to recur again, why would you work in this lifetime? We'll sort of get them next time, you know. But he said, what people don't understand, which is related to this idea of recurrence, is the idea that there's a limited possibility for everything in life. So, okay, we recur and recur, but even recurrence is limited. So at some point, you either have to make the soul, or your possibilities are exhausted, I suppose, or that particular element is extinguished or devolves into something lower. I don't know. It's too complex for me. But like, I think that's a really interesting point about what he's saying, is that he does differ from other religious teachings. I think he does say that, you know, man does have a soul, but it's an it's not a realized soul, and that we have to realize that soul.
Yeah, I mean, at one point in Nicole, he says like the masses of humanity will evolve, but he says it's
over huge time periods. Yeah.
According to the evolution of the solar system.
Yeah.
So a person like you might feed the moon and linger on the moon and maybe be reborn at some point and have different lives and be in the lower realms, and your evolution into the higher worlds might be over millions and millions or even billions of years, over huge time periods with the evolution of the solar system, which Gurdjieff says, and like to us in our individual life, that kind of evolution over that period, like that's, you know, we want to evolve in this life. We're not, you know, we want to step up the process and to attain to this development in this life, because that otherwise that's just such an immense period of time.
And that's
so I think he leaves it open that eventually all beings might be enlightened again and return to self.
And that's the flip
self.
Side to he's saying that everything proceeds in different levels of scale, and that the mass of humanity on our, you know, our governed by an order of scale that we can't comprehend and we can't fathom, but for the individual human being, they have possibilities that are not granted to the mass of humanity. So they can, individuals can evolve consciously and can attain a soul and can develop to the higher levels of being and to become man number 4, 5, 6, or 7. And the other side of it is what he told when he was talking to Fritz Peters, and he's talking about the acorns, and he's saying what will happen to most of those acorns is that they'll go back into the earth and they'll be fertilizer for future oak trees and future acorns. And he says, you know, nature never wastes anything. It's all for a purpose. So that's the kind of situation we're in. We're all seeds, in a sense, of higher beings. But in order to, you know, we have the potential within us to be realized as these higher beings, but most of us won't, and we'll return, you know, ashes to ashes, dust to dust, and we'll return, and more souls will be born, and, you know, they'll have their process that they go through too.
It's very interesting to see how the events of current times on kind of international and national levels, like all the madness of humankind, you know, how, like everything, how, you know, the public has been so deceived about 9/11 and all the, what's going on in our society, kind of like how criminal the governments have been and how much people have been deceived. And then now, like, all of a sudden, there's this kind of awakening of people beginning to realize all the lies they've been told. and kind of awaking to the horror of what's happened in the world, all these terrible things that are being done that we've been lied to about. And I think this is one period of time for people. These awakenings are the shocks that can help tear down, break down that false level of ego that we were kind of soothed into, or the kind of deceived into. Like all of a sudden, I think this, like in the evolution of an octave, those shocks can be, ideally, a person can provide or help provide those for themselves in what Gurdjieff calls the conscious shocks. But sometimes the shocks are things that occur outside of oneself that can serve to shock a person, to wake them up, to make that step in evolution. And I think that what's unfolding on the planet now, for many people, is a shock point where they're kind of like awakening to the horror of our situation and the seriousness of it. And it's like people are getting back to like, wow, my God, like what's important in this life, and basic survival, and you know, I mean, the shock can create a devolving cycle for many people, where they become so concerned with their own survival and the struggle to continue their existence, and they might turn to violence and you know, just stay in the lower cycle of activities. But for other people, it can be a shock and start waking them up to, you know, I think...
Well, I kind of, you know, it's very hard to say. I mean, I kind of, you know, I wrote about this in my first book that I wrote about, sort of about something of a spiritual autobiography. And I kind of focused on the period in the late 70s when the nuclear situation seemed to be particularly prominent and was a real concern to people. And I mean, I thought that in human history, in a sense, you could say that represented a very unique time, in the sense that never before had humanity been faced with the possibility of its utter destruction because of the possession of the nuclear bomb, and an awareness that this is a possibility, that this was going to happen. I mean, you know, you could say, well, there have been other things and events in human history, like, you know, plagues and diseases that have wiped out huge portions of populations, like the Black Death killed, you know, like a huge portion of Europe, and different flus and things throughout the ages. But really, those people didn't know it. You know, like, I mean, they didn't have the communication, and they didn't have the world consciousness that in terms of communications that we have in the, you know, today, the 1970s. Yeah. And we were aware, I mean, people all over the world, you know, no matter what country they lived in, were aware that we have these things, these nuclear weapons, and that they certainly had the, you know, capacity to destroy everyone on the planet. And I mean, I think that may have represented one of those shock points. And like, Gurdjieff talks about that in Search of the Miraculous. He talks about these crossroads in human times where things happen and possibilities exist on the planet. And he talks about it in cosmic terms, about that certain forces are you know, influencing the Earth and create special periods when certain things can happen. And he says it's possible to understand this, but most people can't understand it and can't recognize it. It's quite impossible in some ways to determine it, but they certainly represent points of, as I say, like he calls them crossroads, when things could go one way or the other, you know.
Yeah.
And we may have passed those crossroads. I mean, we may have, you know, it may have been the invention of electricity was a crossroads. Who knows, you know? I mean, it's hard to say in terms of, I mean, we don't understand where we are in a whole lot of respects of things, but as you say, I think it's an interesting time. One thing I just wanted to say about octaves that we didn't talk about earlier is that, like, when Gurdjieff first presented these ideas in Moscow in 1912 to groups that he was working with, and he started teaching his system, and he's talking about, he said that the law of octaves, that in science at the time, science posited the the continuity of vibrations, that things continued unless the medium in which they were progressing, the resistance in that medium overcame the vibrations and brought them to a halt. And essentially he's saying that when he's talking about the continuity of vibrations, this, like I say, this is in 1912, but I remember reading this physicist talking about it, and he's saying, in a sense, what the law of octave is describing, he's describing quanta, and that it's really, it's a quantum process. He's seeing these discrete steps, you know, and that things proceed. But what's added to it is the idea of the octaves, of the intervals in the octave. I mean, well, first of all, the idea of the octave in itself is something, but it's also the intervals, which provides a very different understanding of things. But as I say, this is in 1912, you know, this is before, I think, Planckian theory came after that, eh? Like, didn't Planckian theory come, like, in the late 1920s? Or?
No, I thought it was in 1905 or 1906 hypothesis. But, I mean, it took time to develop. It was that period that Gurdjieff was...
I'm not sure.
It might have been emerged. I don't know.
And that's, I mean, when Gurdjieff was talking about this, he had been taught this many years before. He didn't sort of discover it that afternoon. So it's like, you know... It's an interesting intellectual parallel that, you know, he was talking about quanta before, you know, or this isn't something that people have suddenly discovered. It's like that quote, excuse me, that you have on your website where Jonathan Cott is talking to Lawrence Kushner, who's a rabbi and a scholar of the Kabbalah, and talks about the Kabbalah and modern science, and Kushner's talking about, you know, 14th century rabbis talking about point sources of light as at the beginning of the universe.
Yeah, the supernal point.
Supernal point, you know, in the 14th century. These ideas have been around for you know, hundreds and thousands of years. You know, I mean, the Vedas and the Upanishads contain wisdom of, you know, thousands of years old, and the Kabbalistic teachings, you know, are very ancient, and, you know, the ideas that precede the Christianity, going back to the Coptic teachings or the Pythagorean teachings, you know, all of these teachings are very old, and they're arrived at in ways that are very different from modern science, and yet there's this startling parallel in terms of many of the ideas, and that there's this dialogue that can be created by integrating the esoteric and mystical ideas with the modern scientific ideas. It's really, really quite extraordinary. And that's what's so interesting in your work, is that I think that more than anybody whose work I know, I think that you've taken this in many directions by combining like Blavatsky and Gurdjieff and other esoteric teachings, but especially Blavatsky and Gurdjieff, in developing this very interesting model of consciousness, which applies both psychologically and cosmologically. And then
I think the third element that then came into it further, like after I was invited to L.A. to be involved in that Guy Ritchie movie on Kabbalah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And then I started studying Kabbalistic teachings more.
Yeah, of course.
And especially, like, the Tree of Life is such an amazing kind of mystical symbol.
Yeah.
It really is. And then how the way it descends through four worlds and what they call the ladder of Jacob, divine world, spiritual world, psychical world, and material world. And then you have the four trees of life strung out like that. And, like, that is such a profound kind of mystical, mathematical, scientific symbol of the universe. I mean, it doesn't mean it's true, but it's inherent to that symbol is a model of the nature of higher dimensional space and the nature of the zero point fields. Like the ladder of Jacob, really, that's what it is. It's a model of the inherent structure of the quantum vacuum. That's what it is in modern terms.
Yeah, and you know, I mean...
So I think the Kabbalistic teachings then really helped also, like the Gurdjieff influence, and then Vedic teachings, and then Blavatsky, and then the Kabbalistic teachings, to see the commonality of the laws of three and seven. That's really profound.
Yeah, and you know, like when I mean, again, this is like I say that, like, I would characterize your model of consciousness as that human beings are multidimensional beings who exist in a multidimensional universe, and that's essentially what's missing in modern psychology, and I would say modern science, is this idea of the hierarchy of world orders and of levels of consciousness and the levels of being. And you know in the Bible, when Jacob falls asleep and has his dream, he sees the angels going up and down the ladder, right? Well, like, that's the evolutionary and involutionary processes. That's a symbol of the evolutionary and involutionary processes. That's the dynamics of creation. Things are always evolving and things are always devolving, you know, human beings stand between these two currents, and they can either devolve it according to the mechanical nature of reality and the processes of entropy, or they can evolve consciously, and that's the extraordinary position, that's the freedom that we have, and that leads to an entirely different understanding of everything, including the nature of evolution.
Reminds me of Bob Dylan's line, he not busy being born is busy dying.
Yeah,
and I think that's really true. You're either like waking up and evolving and making an effort to perfect your being. Like, I like that in the Gurdjieff term.
Yeah.
We want to strive toward self-perfection in terms of being. And that's kind of attaining to this development in ourself. I want to go back just for a minute. You touched on something that's so profoundly important about how, like, when Gurdjieff in 1912 was kind of talking about the law of the octave and said how it had to do with the discontinuity of vibrations, that nature isn't continuous, but there's a discontinuity.
Yeah.
And I wanted just to illustrate that, and I think the most interesting example is when you have an atom and you have an electron circling that atom, if that electron absorbs a photon, it then jumps into a higher orbit,
right,
surrounding the atom, and it'll circle in the higher orbit. And then it could absorb another photon and jump into a higher orbit. So by absorbing photons, the electrons jump orbits. And around the atom are seven possible orbits, seven shells. That's why there are seven rows of elements in the periodic tables. So these electrons are always jumping between these orbits of the seven orbits of the atom. And now what's so interesting, you see, say the electron is in one electron shell, and then it absorbs a photon, it jumps into the next shell. Now, that means that it's not halfway in between the two shells. Like, it's not in one and then it doesn't move in a continuous fashion to its second level. No, in a way, it's like it disappears from one level and it is in present at a different level. It's as if all of a sudden you're in Toronto, then you're in New York City, and you don't travel to New York City through external space-time. You're just in Toronto, you're in New York, you're in L.A. So, that's why they call it the quantum leap. Like, that's why the quantum leap, you're in one orbit, and then you absorb a photon of light, and then you kind of attain to this higher orbit. But you're not, there's distinct levels. It's not continuous. And within the level, there's continuity of development of things, phenomena. But then there are these levels which there's a discontinuity.
Yeah.
And, that's such an important part of the idea of the law of the octave, is this discontinuity of vibration. That's why we can exist on different vibration levels simultaneously, and yet we in our conscious mind cannot sense this or be aware of this. And yet then we might attain awareness of it. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that discontinuity, that's a big idea of the law of seven, is that's so vital to that.
Yeah.
And that's like the difference between the man number three and the man number four. There's a discontinuity of vibration. And the whole nature of the individual changes in a way.
Yeah.
It's something fundamentally different. Like, that's evolution.
And that's the idea, I think, that most contemporary thinkers are completely blind to and don't understand. Like, I mean, if you take most of the discussion about the nature of religion and whether or not there's a God, and the so-called conflict between science and religion today, and you have these people who are claim to be rational and skeptical see no evidence, all the usual kind of positions. And I mean, a couple of things that really are so striking that to me and you know, what you've been outlining in your books for so long is that, see, they don't understand that your perception and your construction of reality is dependent upon your level of consciousness and being, because they don't recognize anything other than, well, when you're asleep, you're asleep, and when you're awake, you're awake. And those are the two basic levels. It's very dualistic. There are two levels of consciousness and being. You're either asleep or awake, and that's it. And they don't recognize that it's possible to evolve and to develop higher levels of consciousness and being. And with that, what comes with that is a development of a perception of different world orders and subtle dimensions, and the capacity to actually be conscious in these dimensions, and the development of certain powers and capacities, many of which people ascribe to themselves in a normal waking state of consciousness that they don't possess. But also, so there's that aspect to it. But they don't recognize the possibility, of course, because they don't recognize the possibility. They don't recognize that human history has been filled with amazing figures throughout the ages, like repeatedly through all cultures, through all ages. There have been these people who have developed these capacities and who have been teachers and spiritual figures, holy men, holy women, who have developed and have left these teachings and have provided these incredibly coherent and elegant commentaries on the nature of human consciousness, the nature of reality, the nature of God and spirit, and the existence of the universe and the structure of the universe. It's extraordinary and this is a Western thing since the Enlightenment, basically, is that we're all equal in a sense, in the sense that we're all on the same level of consciousness. There's no recognition that there's any kind of possibility of higher developments of consciousness, and there's no recognition that the possibility of developing these higher levels of consciousness speaks directly to the nature of the true nature of religious teachings and what they really mean. So that's what's kind of missing in the entire debate, entire critique of religion by modern scientists and atheists and skeptics and people who see no reason and no evidence. I would say that through the study of esoteric mysticism, the evidence is overwhelming for the nature of spirit and soul and higher spiritual principles and life principles and the higher dimensions and everything that these people say that there's no evidence for. It's like, to me, it's like the evidence is so overwhelming, so compelling, so indisputable that really these people are just senseless in a sense. Senseless in a sense. They're senseless and they're blind, and that's what's so intriguing about to me about the esoteric tradition, is it just opens your eyes to so much of what's staring people in the face, and they just can't see it.
Yeah, I think, like, I see that in like the intellectual writings which underlie the New World Order stuff, like H.G. Wells and who's that? Bertrand Russell and Huxley and the eugenicists and their kind of they think like the evolution of man is kind of developing your mind in your head, so your brain, you can attain more and more with your brain and your head.
Yeah.
And your mind, it's becoming super intelligent. And you see, the guys who articulated this intellectual philosophy were very intellectual. Like, that's what they were, intellectual types. And you can even see it, and you hear them, and in a way, they're kind of empty-headed. Like, I read some Bertrand Russell, kind of the way he talks about, like, culling the flocks and reducing population and war and famine and starvation and methods for population reduction and stuff like that. And he's just this kind of like guy who's so inflated in his mind, in his head, in his false ego as to his own intelligence and brilliance, kind of. And really, he's like how Gurdjieff describes a hot air pie.
Yeah.
If you prick a hole in it, the whole thing...
Yeah.
Kind of deflates.
Yeah.
And in a way, they're like that. That, like, it's this superficial, limited consciousness and kind of, like, gobbledygook propaganda that they have. Like,
yeah,
for instance, like how they think, you know, the Earth can only sustain 500 million people, so we have to reduce the world's population to be sustainable. So we'll kind of poison the food and poison the air and poison the water and behave in a completely criminal way all around the world to try to attain this, because only then will the world be sustainable. And the whole time they're kind of destroying the water, the air, the land. You know, they're creating possibilities of huge kind of wars and conflict and starvation. They're kind of like such psychopathic minds, people who are so kind of deluded in the mind in a way. You know, and I see this like people like Kissinger, you know, power is the aphrodisiac, you know.
Ultimate aphrodisiac, yeah.
Sorry? Yeah, it's the aphrodisiac of a man number three, kind
of. I see it more like, you know, just like, you know, Gurdjieff says misuse of sexual energy underlies all human psychopathology, and that that's kind of what I see, is that these people that in general are just I would distinguish between the politicians and the madmen who run things, and these intellectuals like Bertrand Russell, who I read some material from Bertrand Russell and Jacques Monod, the biologist who won the Nobel Prize, the French biologist who talked about the lack of meaning of existence and the futility of it all. It was like all this stuff, you know. And I remember reading Capra was talking, Friedrich Capra was talking with Heisenberg near the end of his life, and he noticed that he had been reading Jacques Monod's book on Chance and Necessity, I think it's called, and Heisenberg said, you know, such good science and such bad metaphysics, you know, like it's like these people are quite deluded when they extrapolate. I mean, it's kind of ultimately ironic that within science, the first rule you always learn as a scientist is that you shouldn't draw conclusions that are not supported by your data. You know, that science is a method of checking things and checking the postulates and hypotheses empirically by examining data objectively. I mean, in the ideal, and yet because like Carl Sagan knows something about, you know, planetary biology and exobiology and planetary systems, he seems to think that, you know, that this provides him extra insight into the nature of the soul and God and spirit. And I mean, it's the same with all of these guys. You know, it's like Richard Dawkins. You know, he's a biologist, but you know, he makes all these ridiculous pronouncements about the nature of religion and the purpose of life on Earth. And it's like you know, it's completely unscientific when they do these things. And yet, you know, I mean, they're entitled to their opinions on these issues, don't get me wrong, but to say that they're arguing this not because they're a scientist and they have special insight into it, it's like, it's just so, also it's absurd in the sense of, to the true sense of the word, like, you know, something that's cut off from its roots and is meaningless, because these people are trained as scientists. They're not trained as there's limits to their training and to what you can extrapolate from what they know and from what science knows. That's the fallacy of all these arguments, is, oh, well, you know, now we know these things, and I guess the other side of it, too, is that now that we know these things scientifically, we can discount all, you know, religious ideas and teachings. It's completely specious intellectually, but the other side of it, too, is that none of these people see the kind of inherent limits of science as it's defined today, and especially in as it applies to psychology. And so you have, I listen with amusement all the time when I hear people talking about what they're really talking about is the mind, but they keep talking about, well, my brain doesn't do this, or the brain doesn't do that. And, you know, rather than getting into a long, drawn-out argument, I just sort of listen to them and think, okay, you know, but what makes you so sure that that's your brain, you know? Like, it's such a reinforcement of this idea that, you know, your mind is essentially nothing more than your brain, and that we are really the only source of intelligence in us is produced by our brain, generated by our brain. But, you know,
yeah, and
most
then
people
it's in
shock to realize how little evidence there is for that proposition, you know. Like,
yeah, really, it's kind of a set of it's assumptions and a paradigm of understanding. Like,
yeah,
the people who think about consciousness end up thinking consciousness consists
in
their thinking about it.
Yeah.
And it's like the head doctrine,
yeah,
like how all the intellectuals have kind of identified consciousness with the mind in the head and related it to thinking, whereas all the mystics have identified the self within the heart.
The
mind in the head is seen as secondary. That's the kind of center for ego and becomes the basis for false ego, but the self is within the heart. And that's what I see, like, in all these kind of New World Order writings and that. It's like these people have no heart. Like, they kind of egomaniacs. But it's all in support of this false ego. Like, they call it the New World Order. Like, and that's why I always call it the Old World Psychiatric Disorder. Because that's what it is. Like, it's these kind of psychopathologically disturbed people who kind of ascend to power and, you know, aren't awakened in the heart at all, and all they care about is, like, their own greed and power and control and so on. So they're of lower types. It's like the old world, you know, like, it's the same old story. I mean, today in the news, we get the same old story. These people have been murdering people and making money off wars and poisoning people. They've been doing it for decades and centuries.
Yeah.
It's the same old gobbledygook, just more lies, more BS, you know.
Yeah.
By people who don't care. They have no heart. They're kind of like, there's something so deficit in them on a soul level, you know? And a lot, it's, they're like egomaniacs centered in the mind, in the head. It was interesting. I was just reading some of Robert Hare's book on psychopaths, and he was talking, he's regarded as really the world's expert on psychopaths. Very famous Canadian psychologist from British Columbia. He says the key symptoms of psychopathy, and he's talking about, he has two areas, but I'll just deal with the emotional interpersonal. He says glib and superficial, egocentric and grandiose, lack of remorse or guilt. That's like lack of remorse, like, and that's how Gurdjieff describes what he calls hustnamus individuals.
Yeah.
He says they have no experience of objective conscience, he
yeah.
calls it. So they don't experience remorse, whereas Gurdjieff sees remorse as like a key thing in the alchemy of self-transformation.
Right.
Because he sees the awakening of conscience, as he describes it, as the fire that burns away the residue of things in your psychic makeup. So we want to experience remorse of conscience, which comes with the awakening of consciousness and the awakening of the higher emotional center. So the psychopaths, they lack any remorse or guilt, lack of empathy. Empathy, what do you say of empathy? It's like you say, have a heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, like have some heart feeling or sympathy or empathy, caring, whatever, for other living beings or human beings. Like they have a lack of empathy. See, there's something so empty in their heart space that they have no heart. Deceitful and manipulative. And that's kind of like all false ego. It's all like deceit. I mean, you think of any politician. If you could get one politician to really speak the truth on TV, I mean, they would murder the guy right away. They would have to. I mean, you just think of how many lies. Everything they do is built on so many lies. The wars, the financial bailouts, what's being done to people in the country, other poisoning people, all these terribly deviant things. Everything they say is a lie, completely based on lies. It's like a hot air pie.
It's all magnified too by the need to try to manipulate people through the media. So you instead of having any real idea, you just have sound bites and you repeat the same lies over and over again to manipulate people. You know, it's like which is, you know, it's I don't know if you were about elements of the psychopathology, but I wanted to mention something because this really speaks to this. It's like, and it goes back to what I was talking about earlier about the nuclear threat. I was, we were the same age when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened in October 1962, and it was like 13 days in October 1962. It really looked like there was going to be a nuclear war between the United States and Soviet Union over the presence of nuclear weapons in Cuba. And I remember at the time, like, asking my mother if she thought there was going to be a war, and she sort of hesitated. I don't think she wanted to tell me the truth, and she said, yeah, I think there is going to be, and I really think she was really scared. I mean, my mother was smart, you know, and she was really frightened, and I think really thought there was going to be a nuclear war. And I remember I went to my neighbor's house for lunch that day I was probably in the morning, I had this conversation with my mother, maybe the night before, but anyway, the next day I had lunch, and I went to my neighbor's, and I was having lunch, and I was thinking, geez, you know, I mean, what I was having for lunch was fine, but I thought, you know, this is, like, ridiculous. It's like, I'm going to be murdered by these people who I don't even know, and, you know, for something that I don't even understand, and the whole population of the world is going to be murdered by these people. There's something really seriously wrong with people. Like, even guys on death row get to choose what their last meal is. Nobody asked me what my last meal was. I just got served lunch, you know. And I was quite convinced that, like, this is the end, you know. 12 years old. And so I was reading just recently, I read this very, very good book, which I highly recommend, called JFK and the Unspeakable by James Douglas, and it's about the assassination of John Kennedy. And this, he makes a very, very strong and, I think, convincing argument that he talks in detail about what happened in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And if there's a movie out, 13 Days, which is based on Robert Kennedy's memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Very good movie. And essentially what you see in that movie is that the Joint Chiefs of Staff desperately wanted to start a nuclear war with the Russians over Cuba. And, I mean, to the point where Curtis LeMay, who was head of Strategic Air Command in the United States and was a complete psychopath, he should have been taken out and shot. I mean, he was insubordinate to the president and basically just didn't want to follow his orders. And the Joint Chiefs of Staff were very, very angry with that Kennedy wouldn't attack Cuba. And afterwards, Kennedy and Khrushchev, I mean, what really solved the crisis was that there was a back-channel communication through people that they each knew in Washington and New York, and messages were delivered back and forth. That Khrushchev was under enormous pressure to have a war with Kennedy, and Kennedy was under enormous pressure. And they both knew, like, through their back channel communications that, you know, that they were being forced into this war. And afterwards, they developed their relationship more and more through the unofficial communications. And Kennedy came out of that feeling that, this really struck me because I had this feeling, as I say, as a kid, that he came out of it thinking, like, what would have happened to the children of the world? Like, they would have all have been annihilated, these innocents, you know, by these insane policies of our two nations. And he was quite resolved to try to curb he signed the nuclear non-proliferation treaty again against the advice of the generals and the military. And Khrushchev was under enormous pressure too to not pursue it. But what really struck me was that early in his first briefing, when he was first president, Kennedy was briefed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff about a potential first strike option for the United States to start a nuclear war. And in the middle of the meeting, he got up and walked out of the room. He was so disgusted because these guys were talking about starting a nuclear war, and they were quite serious about it, and, you know, wiping out the Russians and the Soviet Union. And he walked out of the meeting, and he turned to whoever was walking with him, and he said, we call ourselves the human race, with the emphasis on we. And I think he had real remorse of conscience from the Cuban Missile Crisis, as I think did Khrushchev. I think they, you know, these were the two guys who, I mean, think of this. You're the leader of your country. You're, inches away from annihilating the human race.
Yeah.
How would you sleep at night knowing that? You know, like, I mean, both
of you. Depends on, who you are. I think the last president wouldn't have minded.
Oh, he'd have got 8 hours, no problem, you know. Like, I was right to do it, you know. I mean, these people, I mean, my respect for Kennedy and Khrushchev both, as a result of reading this book, grew enormously because, as I say, I never really thought that was the case, but my feelings about the American and Soviet military is that basically these guys are all complete psychotics, you know, the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the States and the leaders of the military in the Soviet Union are all nuts, you know, I mean, and quite crazy, like, not a bit crazy, really crazy. Like,
yeah.
Let's get them before they get us, you
know.
And we'll, like, you know, like, it's in, like, in that movie, which is the best movie ever, Dr. Strangelove, you know, when the general gets up and says, I'm not saying we're not going to get our hair mussed, but, like, 50 million dead tots, you know, and he's all happy about it. Like, I mean, that's the mentality of these guys, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, they're like, think of that, you know, like, I mean, like, I mean, these people are respectable, you know? Like, I mean, nobody puts these guys in prison. It's like they give them awards and build statues to them after they're dead. I mean, you know, like, there's something seriously wrong. I was 12 years old, and I knew right then there's something seriously wrong with human beings. And it wasn't until I read Gurdjieff that I understood what it was, is that they're asleep, you know? And we're all asleep, and only a bunch of zombies and sleepwalkers could behave the way that we do. You know, like, there's no other explanation for it. It's like Beelzebub, in Gurdjieff's Beelzebub's tales to his grandson, you know, is this extraterrestrial intelligence who has this perspective on these peculiar three-brained beings of the planet Earth who have in their psyche this peculiar tendency for the reciprocal destruction of beings similar to themselves, which is also known as war. Like, I mean, only human beings could possibly be that disturbed to carry out war for the reasons that we do. Like, it's just...
Yeah, it's also disgraceful.
It's because you're inured to it, because you are exposed to it all the time, it's like you don't really... you don't really see it for what it is. You're desensitized to it. Reading these books, I read several books about the Kennedy assassination, and you know, I remembered that, you know, we can, when I was, 13 years old, I saw a murder take place on television. I saw Lee Harvey Oswald murdered on television. You know, I actually witnessed the murder, as did, you know, millions of other people.
Yeah.
Sunday morning, we saw a guy shot on TV, you know, and I started thinking about it, and then the Zapruder film, you know, you see Kennedy's head blown completely off, you know, and a bit, oh, you know, but we've seen so many acts of violence. I mean, just think of that, you know, the President of the United States had his head blown off by these people who assassinated him, and I mean, they assassinated him as a coup d'etat, like they overthrew the government by assassinating the president,
yeah.
And everything in the last 45 years that's happened since then, leading up to 9/11, it's all directly related to that. Like,
yeah.
You know, there are people who will stop at nothing to get their way, and they're complete psychos and complete criminals.
Yeah, yeah. It's you wake up to it. It's a nightmare.
Yeah.
That's how I see it. Like remorse of conscience is like, holy smokes, what have we become? What's become of America as a nation? You know,
yeah.
Went from kind of like, all of a sudden, like, you know, they've just murdered 1.4 million people, all based on lies, you know,
yeah.
The lies underlying Iran, Iraq, and then the lies before that about Afghanistan. The whole thing is just a big hot air pie. You know, you poke a hole in it, and it's like the whole thing's a fraud.
Hey,
you know, and the whole nation's kind of intentionally deceived through all the propaganda of the media. It's astonishing, really.
Before we're coming up at about 5:46 Eastern time. Before we finish, you mentioned something before we came on air. I think you should mention the review of your book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, Zero Point Metaphysics and Holographic Space of H.P. Blavatsky, and its review by Donna Brown in the Esoteric Quarterly.
Excellent review.
Yeah, well, I mean, for people who don't know, the Esoteric Quarterly is an online journal, very, very interesting publication. And I've just read a couple of articles in it, really high quality, and the review by Donna Brown of Chris's book is very, very good and very insightful, very intelligent piece of writing. And I'm not exactly. Do you know what the link is to that, Chris? Like, I guess if you just Esoteric Quarterly, if you just search that, you'll come up with the link, but.
I think it's www.esotericquarterly.com,
yeah.
I think.
.com, something like that.
Yeah.
And, yeah.
I put the link up on my site.
Oh, okay.
Or I put the review up on my site.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I had actually even thought of reading that at one point because it gives such a succinct summary kind of,
yeah.
Of what the book is about. And
yeah.
Yeah.
Well. I mean, why don't you read it, you know?
Well, I don't think we have time because we've just got 7 minutes left. But, I mean, maybe we'll pick up on that next
week.
Yeah,
I mean, we should come
back
to because we could talk about basically there's enough in the review that we could talk about it for 2 hours. She really captures, though. Donna's really done a wonderful job of capturing what I think is really unique and important about your book and just points to so many intriguing connections and it's really nice to see somebody who has such an appreciation of your work.
It encouraged me also. I sent a copy of my book off to Weiser. I hope Weiser will pick it up, and I feel the need. I've got to get my books into you know, stop just printing them myself and doing it individually and get them into a book form and out there more broadly.
Well, I think it's important too. Like as I say, in this whole, the misrepresentation of the commentaries about the mind. I mean, if nothing else, just the heart doctrine is a challenge to the head doctrine is intriguing intellectually, and I think really challenges the whole assumptive framework. As Stanislav Grof says, you know, one of the most fundamental epistemological assumptions in Western thought is that the brain produces the mind, and yet that's what it is. It's an epistemological assumption. There's no evidence really to support that contention. I mean, it certainly seems reasonable, but it, you know, it's not really when you begin to really explore it. The question is much, much more complicated and is very much much an artifact of that position is very much an artifact of a whole set of assumptions about the things that we've been discussing all afternoon on this program about how we're really the failure to understand that we're multidimensional beings that exist in a multidimensional universe between an involutionary and an evolutionary current under the laws of 1, 3, and 7. I mean, right there, that you know, the even those general principles challenge everything about the conventional wisdom of Western thought and as regards to the nature of mind and consciousness.
Yeah, it's a shame. I view a lot of the movies on the internet and how they talk about the kind of New World Order elite and how they're all so into occultism and it's a shame because it's like people want to throw out all occult studies because the so-called Illuminati kind of study them, you know? And so they're all bad, kind of. Like the Star of David is an evil symbol, you know? And
Hitler studied the occult. That doesn't mean anything. You know?
Yeah, no, Hitler apparently, like, you know, was most interested in the secret doctrine, which is, you know, I heard somewhere that he slept with it under his pillow.
Really?
Yeah, well, I heard that somewhere recently.
Oh.
Yeah, I actually heard that. I don't know if that's true. I don't
Einstein
know.
Einstein slept with it next to his bed.
Yeah, it's so.
Yeah.
So, but and it's a shame. Then, like, it was funny, a personal experience. I was up part of the 9/11 rally last September 11th on Parliament Hill in Ottawa, and one of the people I was with kind of pointed up to the Peace Tower and pointed out how on the Peace Tower in Ottawa, you know, on the Parliament, the House of Parliament, I call it the House of Criminals. But what used to be the House of Parliament, and it's a Star of David on the clock.
Really?
Yeah. So he's like, oh, look, they even got their Masonic symbol, you know, on the House of Parliament, the clock there. Yeah, it's in the clock. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
And but I said to him, no. Like he says, oh, that means they own it, you know. And I said, no. See the central point that the arms move from the center. So the living entity is the center of the clock.
Wow.
So it's not, see, it's a Star of David with the central point because the hands move from the center. And I said what that really means is that we have to retake it because it's meant for us. It's not meant for them.
Wow.
But it's like people, but, you know, it's sad. Like everyone I see in Alex Jones movie, you know, Blavatsky's portrayed as this kind of satanic woman and, you know, how she named her magazine Lucifer and
right.
The complete misunderstanding of it and
yeah.
How so many, you know, people have such a distorted perspective now on occult studies in a way. And they think a lot of people on the networks I listen to a bit, they think like Kabbalah is bad, you know, it's like the Illuminati and the Zionists.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's like that Frederick Kuz guy that wrote that two-piece thing in the New York Review of Books 15 years ago, and he's talking about Gurdjieff, and essentially by the end of it, he's kind of blaming him for World War II. You know, it was completely ludicrous. It's like, people have superficial understanding.
So anyway, but the laws of 3 and 7 are like keys to understanding esoteric literature and have all kinds of application. And
yeah.
I need to try to bring it to a close. You just got a couple minutes left here.
Yep.
So we've explored widely today, but stuck with esoteric studies more, trying to talk about the laws of 3 and 7 and the idea of evolution and the awakening of the heart center, how important that is and how our soul is connected to our heart and trying to, you know, we on this earth, we have to be awakening ourselves and, you know, we need to take our world back because we're in times which I think there's going to be some pretty heavy shocks coming our way. And it's time we need to take our world back somehow and expose this criminality and get back to our basic concepts of human justice and freedom and love for our neighbors and so on. So we're quite an epic tale going on the planet at this time. You know, will we end up part of the old world psychiatric disorder, or will we really have a new age and take back the wealth of nations and reverse these criminal trends in our societies? So anyway, so my website is at www.zeropoint.ca. This is a fascinating book, God, Science, and the Secret Doctrine, a unique kind of book in the world at this time, showing the validation of Blavatsky's teachings. And thanks very much, Jim. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And thanks, BBS Radio. Are you still there, Jim?
Yep, thanks to Doug and Don.
Yeah, thanks, Doug and Don. Yeah, remember yourself, as you go around your life, tap yourself over the heart sometimes as you go about living your day and try to bring your consciousness into your heart. The best way to realize the heart doctrine is through directly in your own experience. And that's what's most important in understanding consciousness, not theoretically, but within yourself. Okay, thank you all.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Bye.
Goodbye.